This is the First Time Podcast.
Part reality series.
Part writer's masterclass. It's a podcast about the first time
you publish a book.
I'm Kate Mildenhall.
And I'm Catherine Collette. Welcome to The First Time.
Kate, it's September 9th today, which means the Mother Fault came into the world 1 week ago.
It did. It's my 1 week old baby. And you know, there are still, shout out to the local florist, the flowers in here are still doing really well. The balloons, not so much.
The balloons were great. I wanted to ask you, the backdrop was fabulous.
Oh my gosh, the balloons are not my doing. Can I shout out right now to my friend Tess, who is so extraordinary. She's been my friend since grade three, and she's so amazing and competent and efficient that she had got a graphic designer to color match the balloons with the cover so that they were the correct color. So, oh my gosh.
If we are in lockdown when my book comes out, that made me think of how important a backdrop would be. And I think I would aim to get like a shimmering curtain of like foil kind of colours.
Oh, yes.
That would be amazing.
Yeah. I think I've seen Zoe Foster-Blake with something similar for like her birthday.
And just theme it.
Yeah. Go big. And also because it really, I must admit, it totally put me in the mood for a party. You know, like when... for all the things that I could have been curled up in a ball going, I want to go to the party with all my friends. And it felt like a party with all my friends anyway. The cleanup the next day was a bit, and the hangover, let's be honest, was a bit like I'd had a party with 200 friends anyway. So I highly recommend it just for getting the vibe. You know?
But that vibe came through the screen. I felt the same way. Like it was such a, I put on Instagram, I'm just about to cry and it hasn't even started. Like I was really feeling it.
I loved that. There's been a few tears.
So let's rewind and look at the last week, but we'll start with the lead up.
Yeah.
One of the things I really liked that you did, I don't know if I've mentioned this before, but on Instagram and Facebook, you had these beautiful plates that had the Mother Fault theme and they had questions on them.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about that.
I can. So this was something that...
I loved them.
You know, they, you know, your publicist asks you for, or the publisher asks you for like some things that you could write about, or maybe you're doing blog posts or things like that. And at one stage, because I've got the journal, can I just say again, journal has come into its own, but because I was going through that to like find things to write about, I noticed how many times I had questions in there. So I just pulled them all out and dumped them into another document. And I had about 100 and I was like, oh, I don't know. Could I pitch this as kind of an article? And Anna, my incredible publicist, said it would work really well as something that you did as a series. So I was like, okay, I can do that. I know how to use Canva now. I'm going to try. I checked that it was okay.
Did you do them yourself?
I did them myself.
Oh, my God.
Like, obviously, I asked, I used the graphic and, you know, I asked if I could do that. But then I just played around with Canva and I obviously asked my friend Shay what was important. And she said what was good about having... numerous tiles there because I wasn't sure how cool that was to, you know, swipe through, but that, you know, you keep people there longer if they do want to engage in that. So that's a good thing. She said it was important not to have them in a row. So I had to make sure that I was posting stuff in between, which is the opposite of if your publisher does or you make a beautiful thing over the grid that you can't post in between. But what I really liked about it was also because it, you know, then I had to kind of work out, oh, what questions are they and what am I going to ask? But it did kind of seem to sum it up in a way and I hoped it was like making people think about it. It felt a little bit revealing in places too, like I was being a little bit vulnerable, but I realised that that's just my thing. I am like that, so that doesn't, yeah, but I did do it myself.
There were just, I mean, can you give an example?
So I had things like I divided it up between like the big questions and the little questions. So big questions were like, you know, how do I feel safe in the world? And little questions were like, you know, how long does it take to infection to start at sea? So they were all questions that I'd had to research or things like that. Questions that I asked myself, like, you know, is the sex too vanilla? questions.
Oh, I remember that one. Yeah. That was great.
You know, like all those things, questions that I wondered if readers would like me or like, you know, the way I'd written about things. Yeah, it was fun to do. And there was quite a bit of engagement in it, which in terms of if we're just thinking about putting on our publicity hats and thinking about that, you know, you want to have engagement with people reading. You don't just want to like have showy things that people are just swiping past, I think is the key.
It was great. And I guess it's a good activity for the lead up because the lead up is a funny time.
Yeah. And you know, the other thing that happened, it gave me a plan the week before because I knew I was doing that each day. I was kind of posting them at different times. But then on actual launch day, I was like, shit, I don't know what to post today. Like I'd run out of things to post. It was all so crazy and incredible that, yeah, anyway. So I would recommend that to people.
Let's talk about launch day. Publication day and launch day were the same day. What did the day look like?
The day looked very exciting. My darling neighbour had made a champagne breakfast on our, socially distanced, of course, on our fence because we share a fence line, which was really exciting. And then, honestly, then the delivery started with the balloons and they did not stop all day. And what was so delightful about that is, you know, when you go to a launch, like maybe some people bring flowers and cards and things, but also the whole point is that you're going and you're going out and you're probably going and spending a bit on drinks afterwards and the rest of it. So you don't necessarily take gifts, but I think people all felt that it was, you know, so disappointing not to have a launch that they literally showered me in gifts. Like I was completely and utterly overwhelmed. My kids got a bit annoyed. I mean, there's a whole other conversation about, because it was like Christmas, but all for me. So that was a bit much. But it was really lovely and I was excited. I was excited about the launch. I was terrified that something was going to happen to the internet. I was terrified that the kids weren't going to cope with it. And, you know, they did obviously make an appearance at the end, which was rather amusing and delightful. But it was fun. And at the end of it all, I lay on the couch and made Adam read out messages to me and had a whiskey and cried. That was the end.
Oh, what a day.
It was a big day. It was a big day, but yeah.
But a good one. And Charlotte Wood was the launcher, our resident agony aunt.
She was.
Had you and her talked much prior?
We hadn't really. She'd asked, you know, is there anything not to ask or anything that you do want me to ask, and given me a heads up about one of the questions. But what I've realized, and I wanted to make this point if it's useful to people, because the only other event I've done, not the only other event, the other conversations I've had are with Sarah Bailey and with Trent Dalton this week, and which was great as well. But what was delightful, the questions were all really different. I got none of them in advance. And I don't really know those three people very well. I mean, like I do professionally, but I don't know them very well. And what it meant was that I had this element, like when we're interviewing someone for the podcast, I had this element of the way that I was preparing for it. There was no angstiness of like, I certainly wasn't going to message any of them beforehand and say, oh, can we do this? Or I'm a bit worried about this or anything like that, because we don't have that relationship. And I think that it helped my mindset of being really kind of grounded and centered and treating it like work as well, which is quite helpful.
Any questions that stumped you? Did you have any of those moments, or you just had enough to be able to pick it up?
And you know, on Wednesday night, I was really conscious the whole time, and rightfully so, because my eldest daughter had a go at me afterwards about it. I was really conscious that my kids were there. And that, you know, it's a book about motherhood and the difficulties of that. So that made it a little bit, that was something in the back of my head. Trent on Monday night, Trent asked me about my dad and the dad in the book. And that stumped me. Like it was like I realized that part of the book and the import of it just when he asked me the question. And I had this kind of moment of being stuck and a bit emotional. But I think the beautiful thing about these kinds of weeks, and once you start getting out there, and I'm sure that other writers will respond to this, and you might think this too from the helpline, is that once people start asking you questions and reviewing or whatever and reflecting the book back to you, you can also start articulating it better.
Yeah.
Because they're using that kind of language around it thematic stuff and they're responding. So you suddenly have a language to talk about it more as well. And that's so useful. It's so useful.
It does evolve, doesn't it? Also, I think as you start to have done some interviews and there starts to be more out there, as an interviewer, you can start to see things in different ways. When there's nothing out there, you really have to,
yeah.
It's very coming at it from an individual perspective.
Yeah, I agree with that, definitely.
I got the monthly delivers, I think it was last week it came, opened it up, big ad for the Motherfault, and then looked on the website and you're on the front page, review.
Oh, my goodness. Nice. And that review, that was one that I had to get Adam to read to me. It was an amazing review. It's such a gift to get a review like that and to get any review, really, but to get a review where they just get it. I actually sent a message.
Just the certain words lined up together make it such a, like, it just pops off the page, you know, like the good gothic thriller, yeah. Domestic motherhood.
I was such a strange combination. It honestly made my week. But again, that thing of I really have decided. I think I'm going to print things out. I said to my husband, I said to Adam, because he sometimes gets messages from clients in his work. He's a psych nurse. He works with the homeless community. You know, like kind of you've saved my life messages, which are extraordinary, and we all look at them and share them about, and it gives him, like, you know, all the good feels for a couple of weeks. And I said, imagine if you got, I know it's a completely different thing, but in terms of that being positive feedback for his work, I said, imagine if you got all those messages in 1 week, like,
yeah.
And he said, oh, there would be no way I could cope with that. And I was like, that's what this feels like. Like, you know, you sit on your own for 4 years writing something you're not sure that anyone will like. And then in 1 week, everyone says they love it. And you have to try and comprehend that. And it's big and amazing and wonderful.
It needs to be rationed better, doesn't it?
It needs to be rationed out. And that's what I think. I'm going to print them out. And also because, you know, me, Clever Clogs, Kate, who said, I'm going to respond to every single person who says anything this time around. Well, I am sorry to the people who I've not yet responded to. You are flagged in my inbox or somewhere. I'm getting to you. Thank you.
Keep them coming.
Keep them coming, please.
So from here on in, any places that people can catch you coming up in the next little while?
Yes, they can. So I am speaking with Northern Books on Tuesday the 15th, which is online. They're all online, so you can come to any of these. And they are a regional Victorian bookshop, so they would dearly love your support. Yarra Valley Writers Festival Book Club on September 23rd, and a really good one I'm looking forward to on September 29th with Jock Sarong for Better Read Than Dead. So we're talking about, like, we're interviewing each other kind of in the conversation about his new book, The Burning Island, and The Motherfault. So there'll be lots of sea-related discussion, I imagine, in that one. Anyway, they're all in. I've made myself a link tree thing. Catherine, you'll be very impressed with me.
Oh, amazing. Mm-hmm. I've often wondered about those.
Yeah, so easy. So that's on my bio on Instagram, or they're all up on my website now, I think, as of this morning. I think I've got them all there. It's so funny. But yes, please come to those things. Ask. One of the things that I heard was that a couple of places sold out very quickly, a couple of bookshops. So, you know, please just ask your bookshop if they don't have it. To get it. These are the things we need to say at the moment. And thank you to all the incredible people who've supported already.
So happy. Okay, before we get into this interview with the wonderful Laura Elvery, can we just plug a couple of things? One is her book. We get sent a lot of books for this podcast, proof copies and normal copies. I'm not sure why I'm making that distinction. This is a killer collection of short stories. It is so freaking good. If you're not a short story reader, this is a really good place to start. The premise is women who've won the Nobel Peace Prize. Hopefully I'm getting that right.
Nobel Science Prize.
It's such a good book. It just is both interesting and a book where you go, God, that's a good sentence.
God, that's a good sentence. I was just about to say that. I put it down so many times to say, damn you, Laura Elvery, you and your perfect sentences.
It's a bit like Mel Cheng's Australia Day.
Yes.
You're just like, I have to
put- Same. I just... And don't you think that's the thing? Like, I love it when you read a book fast, but then there's some books where you just have to read them slow and you savor every bloody sentence. This is one of them.
Yes. Joy. And you read with this sense of joy and jealousy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just like, wow, that's good. Anyway, shout out to that. I've got more.
Do you, Keep shouting.
I'll do another one too. So we're going to do a proper deep dive with many, many spoilers into The Motherfault in the next couple of weeks. Mm-hmm. So your questions will help me a lot. So will Cassie Hamer. So Cassie has actually been on an episode of the First Time Podcast, a live one that we did in Sydney. She's written the best-selling book, After the Party. So she has recently become a kind of book correspondent,
yeah,
I think is what you'd call her role, for the book podcast with Rosemary Puddy. And she's done a great dissection of The Motherfault, episode number 167. So between her analysis and your questions.
That was amazing. And we should say too that Cassie is one of those divine humans who had a book come out at the beginning of this pandemic. So her second one is The End of Cuthbert Close, and you should get on that.
So she's going to be a resident. I'm calling her a book correspondent. They probably have a better name for it for the book podcast. It's really, really good listening and just good industry news.
Yeah.
So who's heading up Sydney Writers Festival now, all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, loved it.
A half hour to her and you'll be quoting her ever after.
And you had another podcast too that you wanted to shout out to.
Is Ashley Kalajian Blunt's James and Ashley Stay at Home. Something good about when a thing is perfectly named.
Yeah.
So this podcast is a podcast about writing, staying at home and health. And it's really, really fun. Ashley was recently on our Conversations with Friends. She strikes me as someone who's just interested in everything.
She's amazing.
Chemistry.
And her book is so much fun. How to Be Australian is so much fun. I'm actually going to be on this podcast very soon, which is very exciting. And we have amazing new supporters via our Patreon. So we need to shout out to these names. Thank you so much for your support.
Bianca Milroy, Meg Dunley, Petronella Nicholson, Sarah Christensen, and Mandy, one name only.
We love you. You're That's amazing. Nice. Thank She's you so much.
Before we get into today's interview, we have a new section for the podcast. Charlotte Wood almost needs no introduction, but I'll give her one anyway. She is the award-winning writer of 5 novels and 2 non-fiction works, including The Writer's Room, which is all about the creative process. She's also our new resident agony aunt. Charlotte's going to be here each episode answering any questions you have about writing. Honestly, the juicier the better. So if you want to send in a question, the address is hosts@thefirsttimepodcast.com. And now, this week's question.
Dear Agony Aunt, I have a completed manuscript that has been shortlisted in 3 noteworthy competitions and has been read by a couple of publishers. My manuscript falls into the category of a quiet novel. Quiet novels are what I love to read and write. One publisher told me it's very hard to sell a debut quiet novel. Does this mean I am doomed never to publish? How do I break into the market without selling out? Yours sincerely, Dispirited.
Well, hello, dear Dispirited. Take heart is my advice to you, because quiet novels are also what I love to read and love to try to write. So I do feel your pain, and I absolutely don't think you're doomed never to publish, but you might be doomed to having to change, which is to say improve your writing. And that is great, because it's the same fate that awaits all of us in this writing life, and it's pretty much never going to go away, the need to get better. And it's also not called selling out, it's called getting better. And I think often the answer to the question of how can I get published is just write a better book. Now, that's not to say that bad books don't get published. Obviously, they do. Plenty of people would say that my whole career is testament to that fact, but I, you know, it's very subjective. You can laugh out loud. I love laughing. You know, but it's true. And the other thing is that publishing has a lot of luck, a lot of karma. There's fashion involved in, you know, publishing trends. So there's a whole lot of stuff you can't control, but the only thing that you can control is the quality of your writing. But I honestly believe that a really good book, a really good book, will almost certainly find a publisher eventually. And there's also a lot you can do in learning to write and get better to make it much harder for a publisher to reject you. I think it's also really worth us stepping back a moment and thinking about what this description, a quiet novel, actually means. Because it can actually just be a bit of a euphemism. It can be a sort of catch-all term that publishers use when they just think a book is a bit sort of blah, you know. Or so, yes, quiet novels can be hard to sell, but the problem might not actually be its quietness, is what I'm getting at, I guess. You know, publishers don't want to hurt your feelings, and they also don't have time to actually give you a thorough critique of your book to, you know, offer you a really detailed sense of why this quietness seems to be a problem for them, or even what they think it is. It's just a quick way of saying, oh, it's very quiet, we can't sell it. You know, they could easily equally say it's very loud, because, you know, it's sort of, it's a bit meaningless. However, I think that sometimes new writers believe, and I was one of these people, believe that beautiful sentences should be enough to sustain a book. But really, it just isn't enough. You know, a beautiful turn of phrase, a good eye for detail, it's just, that's only one bit of a book. It's a bit that's really important to me and obviously to you, Dispirited, but it's not everything. So books that we often think of as quiet from writers like the ones I've listed here, Alice Munro or Elizabeth Strout or maybe Sigrid Nunez or Joan Silber or Gail Jones, any number of, you know, the finest writers alive, when you read them properly, the stories actually have very high stakes and the characters often are taking enormous risks. And all of these writers have a very strong, even if it's very subtle, command of narrative tension. And the writing itself, the voice of the writing, carries an enormous authority. Often, well, these books, these writers always also have something fresh to say about our society, about relationships between people, you know, about where we are in our world now. So when someone just says, oh, your book's very quiet, they might be meaning that it lacks a number of these things. It might lack a certain kind of energy that comes from taking a few risks. I just want to quote here from a little speech I gave a few years ago for a Stella Prize event about my love of Kate Jennings' book, Save Me, Joe Lewis. And what reading that book showed me about my own early attempts at fiction. Now, I'm not suggesting for a minute that Dispirited's book is suffering from these problems, but it might be helpful to other people who are kind of interested in this stuff as well. So this is what I said. I can see now that at that time my writing, much like my life, was infused with a subtle form of self-pity and a dreary kind of self-promotion. It wasn't that I wrote about myself in my work, or not exactly, but rather that flowing beneath the pallid fictional surface of all of my stories was a small, shameful, but urgent desire to be admired. My characters back then were invariably sensitive young women. Inexplicably, men treated them callously. My young women observed their worlds closely. They noticed things, like dust motes turning in the air, or the dropped flower of a frangipani on the footpath, or the steam rising from a cup of tea. And these young women felt things very deeply, lyrical things and political things. They felt very intensely. They were willowy and sad, and they arranged themselves in picturesque domestic scenes, and by keeping very still, themselves became decorative. They watched and felt things and said nothing and turned away. The one thing my characters never ever did back then was act, because to act would be to show yourself, to take a risk. and I was not ready for that. Now, I don't want to be too hard on this 23-year-old self of mine. I was just learning to write, after all, as I was just learning to live. But when I reread Save Me, Joe Lewis now, so tied up with my memory of my young self, I see that maybe the reason for all this careful passivity of mine was that, like many young women, I was filled with so much self-doubt that there wasn't any room for self-questioning. I had to shore up all the doubt about myself, men, feminism, politics in general, by concealing any trace of confusion. Like all my friends, I found solace in political beliefs and behaviours so unassailably correct that they could never be challenged, and so I would never have to defend them, and I would never have to risk finding out what I actually thought. But when I read Kate Jennings' book, I began to understand something important, that the disorder caused by tough questions to the self, the energy created by arcing up, opposing your own beliefs for a minute, behaving in a contradictory way, revealing something indecorous about yourself, this was what might give energy and life to my sluggish writing. And now, of course, I think that it is also what gives life to life. So that was a rather longer thing than I thought it was going to be, sorry. What I'm getting at here is that a lot of our writing when we start out is of this "she said nothing and turned away" variety, which mine was for a long time. And that's the kind of writing where everything is implied, everything is interior, nobody really risks anything, and there's nothing really compelling to keep the pages turning. So people might use the word quiet to mean simply boring. That's what my writing absolutely was. And I think some of this quietness is the result of the writer hiding because of what I said in my own case. I was almost too afraid to move in my own life because then I might be seen. And if I was seen, if I said something, then I might be called upon to explain it or defend it. And I didn't have the courage. So I'm thinking I've got three bits of actual advice for our dispirited friend. First of all, I think you should start writing a new book because you have put all the eggs in this basket of this one book. I mean, you've probably done this already, I don't know. But as I've said before, to be a writer is to think about the long haul and the body of work and the kind of continuous improvement and a continuous movement in developing your own skill. So move along from that book, take what you've learned from it and apply those lessons to the new book. The second thing I would do, which I think is a really pleasurable thing to do, is to make a really conscious study of the quiet books that you love. Do a serious close reading and have a look for a few things. Where does the sense of authority come from? Where do the characters take a risk? What kind of risks? And what's at stake when the risk is acted upon? Are there any contradictions within these people? Where does the tension in the story rise and fall? And what's going on around those peaks? I would look for movement in the story and look for conflict or confusion or ugliness, and then ask, what's the nature of that? How is it then externalized beyond the character's own head? Where does the pressure come from? What do you want to happen as a reader? And then what does happen? Or just ignore all of those questions and ask yourself, what is it specifically and in detail that you so admire about these books? In the sentences, in the characterization, in the voice. After you've done all that, then look at your own work with a really clear-eyed view, a sort of detachment if you can, and see where you are failing to do these things and where you might begin to try out a few of the moves that your favorite authors are making. As I said before, you know, maybe you've done all this and it's still, you know, and you think actually the book is as good as Alice Munro or Joan Silver. And it might be the case, and it might be just luck, bad luck. But, you know, if you want to write, you have to keep going and try again. Another option is to have someone professional look at your book, a manuscript assessment, a detailed manuscript assessment. I can recommend a couple of very good assessors in Peter Keneally and Tegan Bennett Daylight, and you can just Google them, and they've got stuff on their websites about manuscript assessment. And ask them for a deep, you know, say, my work has been described as quiet. What do you see as the problem here? Is it that it sort of lags or it's too silent or too static or whatever? It might be just not have enough tension. It might have a storyline that's actually been done a lot elsewhere and better. I hope that hasn't dispirited even more, because I think one of the really exciting things about the writing life is that there is always more to discover. There's always more you can do with your work. There are always changes to try, new ambitions to reach for. And I really hope you can write another book and just aim a bit higher in terms of what you can do. In fact, aim beyond what you can do, because that is where the real excitement lies, and that's where the gold is. And also remember that a great many second books are actually first books that weren't published the first time around. So I would try very hard to treat this as a learning exercise and move on. And then once you begin following your curiosity, really truthfully, trying new things, really getting stuck into the new work, I promise you those dispirited feelings will just fall away. Because that's, we all know this, where the real value of writing for the author lies, in that challenge and absorption and the joy of just making. So when you sort of hang around waiting for a book to be published, that's when you can lose all of your kind of excitement about writing. And the only way to get it back is start writing again. So I hope that is helpful.
Laura Elvery is a writer from Brisbane. She has a PhD in creative writing and literary studies. Her work has been published in Overland, Griffith Review, Meanjin, Kill Your Darlings, and the Big Issue Fiction Edition. She has won the Josephine Ulrich Prize for Literature, the Margaret River Short Story Competition, the Neela Sydney Short Story Prize, and the Fair Australia Prize for Fiction. In 2018, Laura's first collection of short stories, Trick of the Light, was a finalist in the Queensland Literary Awards. Her second collection of short stories, Ordinary Matter, will be released in August 2020.
Laura Elvery, let's start at the very beginning. Did you always want to be a writer?
Did I always want to be a writer? I always spent a lot of time, probably like all your guests, Catherine, like reading and writing, and I used to write little plays for my friends in grade five, and I'd con the teacher into giving us time out to go rehearse these ridiculous.
Oh, bless.
Like, bless Mrs. Sisman, wherever she is. So I used to do all those sorts of things, and I'd fill notebooks and, you know, write novels that ended after four pages, and just like now, basically. So I used to do those sorts of things, but I don't think I ever knew it was you know, filling diaries and things. I don't think I ever knew it was a real job that one could do, Catherine. I didn't think in those terms, no. But I always remember having pages and notebooks stapled together and those sorts of things, yeah.
Now you have won a lot of awards. In fact, I was looking at your UQP author page and you actually have to scroll down.
Great.
Which is so impressive. The list is, so they've got the font size right for that. but do you remember the first short story that you had success with?
Yes. That's a fun memory. I'll have that one till I die. That was really great. So that was, the first one was probably the Josephine Ulrich, and it's also the biggest. The first one was the biggest. I've never won anything as big as that. That's $10,000. It doesn't exist
anymore.
Oh, my
God.
Yeah, I know. No wonder I remember it. Hey, so that was a few years ago. That was 2013, I think. And a friend had told me about it the year before, and he said, let's enter this next year. And I was like, all right. And it was kind of fun because that was before, I don't even know if I'd had anything published by then, maybe one or two things. And so sending that off is like no expectation. I didn't know how the process would work. I posted it. I remember posting it. And then I got a call from lovely Nigel Krauth at Griffith University. And it was a very, like, I pulled over on the side of the road, and I always just assume someone on the phone, you know, wants something from me. And then
it wasn't one of those things that was on your radar. They could be calling this week.
And but now, though, Catherine, when I send things off, it would be a lie to say they're not on my radar. I very rarely forget if I've sent something out, very rarely. But this time I didn't know how that whole thing worked. So I'd posted it off and, you know, never even been shortlist, never entered it before. So that's like a really lucky you know, that's hundreds of entries. And having judged short story prizes since then, there is a real element of luck to it. What the judges, so the judges were Frank Morehouse and Sally Breen. And back then for the Josephine Ulrich, oh my God, it was so much fun. We went down to Griffith University. There was a dinner, stayed at a hotel, read my story out at the dinner.
Oh my God.
It was really fun. It was really terrific. And then you get $10,000. So that feels really special. And that was a story, that story's replica, and that's in
Trickle. Ah, and right.
Yeah.
And so what happened beyond that? So was that, I mean, was that a very early short story that you had written, or you had sort of, I mean, it was the first one you had out there, but it was actually pretty early on in the short story sort of space for you.
I'm nodding. Yes, it was really early. There is something special about that, like just writing it, not really, like I said, not knowing how it worked. So, yes, that was one of the early ones. So when Trick of the Light was published, I think the span of time for those 24 stories is something like 5 years, say. You know, one was written maybe a few months before the book was published, but the earliest probably was that story, probably was Replica. And then after that, I just got really into the idea of, you know, like I'd see a call out for a prize or a journal. And so that just became really good impetus to, okay, there's a deadline. Like I love a deadline, or this short story competition has a theme.
How do you go with themes? Because on the rare occasions I've entered a short story, the theme has been really off-putting, because you have to do something specific. You can't just have something sitting there that you could send out to 100 different ones.
And just
that's right.
Never know.
So is the theme something that's appealing? Do you really use it as a starting point?
Yes, I do. I have found, that Rachel Funari Prize for Fiction, I've entered that a few times and they have a theme each year. Sometimes I like it because it actually, you know, like giving yourself rules like that, it does restrict your thinking a little bit. So instead of going, I have to write a short story about anything, it's like really specific. So I like a bit of rules. But in those early days, you know, like that was 2013, I won the Josephine Ulrich. I was thinking, just here's a deadline and get something ready, anything ready, and you see how you go, or a journal call out or something like that, as motivation to get it going. And then, like it was a slog, but after a while you might have, suddenly I've got 15 stories and 10 of them are okay. And that's kind of how Trick of the Light happened, a bit more organically like that. I've got these stories, here's a book, kind of.
So what was the process? Was UQP always on your radar as someone that you wanted to be published by?
The thing that was on my radar at the start was there's an unpublished manuscript prize in the Queensland Literary Awards. And at the time I was doing my PhD at QUT, and one of the lecturers there was judging it. And so we must have been talking about it. One of the lecturers down the hall from me, we must have been talking about it. And I was like, I could do that. I could. And I remember like writing out the stories I had that I thought were okay and thinking that seems like a number that I could work towards. You know, say I had 10, 12.
Some of them would have been tested. Some of them would have won awards, which is
right. Yeah. Some of them had been published before. So it was that realization that actually these aren't just necessarily distinct pieces, but maybe this could be a book that I enter into an unpublished manuscript prize. And so that was so I submitted that, and I got that shortlisted in the Queensland Literary Awards in 2016. So that got shortlisted, and then Madonna at UQP came up to me at the reception afterwards and gave me her business card and sort of did that thing where I didn't, I thought she was being nice. Like it's before I sort of knew that maybe publishing directors aren't just
nice.
Hand you their business cards at the bus stop. And she, you know, like as in keep in contact, give me a call. I emailed her and I went in for a meeting. And that was like, again, I thought it was a meeting to be nice.
Jeez, people are really nice in Brisbane, don't they? Like...
Yes. Oh, Catherine.
Impressive things.
I've got no idea. And instead the meeting, I think that day was like, we'll take it to acquisitions. And so that I still feel, I remember I said, wow, a couple of times. So that was really nice. And then Ian C was my wonderful editor at UQP. So that was a really lovely experience because, like you said, a lot of the stories had been tested, had been published, edited many times. So it was probably a pretty light edit. And the fun thing was arranging them. Like there are 24 stories. That was really interesting to sort of do that. How does it look as a whole book? And what do we start on? And maybe you need to fill in a couple of blanks and write a couple of new ones here. But there was something nice about at the very beginning not actually knowing it would ever be a book.
Yeah. Mm. Do you think that your approach to writing short stories has changed over time as you've honed that craft? Has the way you've thought about what's important evolved?
It has. I probably don't have as much time to enter things as I did then. As an approach, but I will still see a deadline or a call out. I get a bit addicted to like, I absolutely do not have time to enter that prize. And then 2 days later on, you know, writing the beginning of that story. In terms of approach, this might sound a bit strange, but I really don't go on Goodreads, but the one time I went on Goodreads for Trick of the Light, there was a comment from someone who said all these lovely things, but then she made this really astute comment where she said some of the stories here feel a bit sad, a bit grim. And I was like, that's really good feedback. Thank you, Goodreads.
And a rare moment in which a Goodreads review has
put in the river. and so I think this time around I was conscious of that. I was like, why not? That's one example I can think of how my approach has changed. Why not actually have a go at changing the tone or the texture of your short stories a little bit more? A little bit more of a variance is what I was really consciously deliberate. But I have also read a lot more short story collections in the years since. Like I really love reading short story collections. And there's a couple of stories in The Travellers, the collection by Karis Davies, where she really does give her characters a really positive ending. George Saunders does it sometimes too. I mean, lots of people do that.
Interesting.
As an approach, I was like, see what you can do with this story that you've already begun. How would you end it if it was going to be okay for these people?
I was going to ask you about endings specifically, actually. One of the things that struck me about Ordinary Matter, which is your second collection, which will be out by the time this episode comes out, is it's not always clear what happens. There's a note of ambiguity often. I wondered if you had in your mind what happened or if there was sometimes ambiguity even for you.
Oh, which one do you think is particularly mysterious?
Oh, there's a few that endings in this book was something that really struck me as an art form. And I wondered if it was particular to short stories, because sometimes the short stories I read feel more like a moment, you know, a moment that represents a whole. But I was interested in how you thought about endings.
Ben Walter on Twitter a few weeks ago was talking about the art of the short story ending, and I find them really hard. I guess the short answer is that I do find them. Sometimes I find them really difficult, and sometimes that's where a writer's group is really useful. Not the beginning, you know, not line edit stuff, but just sort of, does this feel right for these characters? Do you have a lot more, you know, many more questions once we've got to this point? But then there are other times when I get to the end and I have absolutely no more questions about it. There is no question in my mind that this is where the story finishes. And I mean, there are stories in Ordinary Matter, like Stockholm, which takes place over an hour. And then the very final story in the collection, A Brief History of Petroleum, covers, I don't know, four decades.
Yeah.
And so if it's inbuilt into the story that this is one where we're going to see in the final story, Phoebe, I want to take her from when she's at high school all the way till she's a woman in her 60s and 70s. Oh, there you go, five decades. Then it's sort of inbuilt in how I'm going to go. I need to get to this point.
Yeah.
Or in Stockholm, where I think, no, the interesting stuff for me right now all takes place in an hour. So what happens at the end of the hour, that's as much as I'm giving characters. This is the part that I'm interested in. And the other thing that I find about endings, and I do really like talking about them, is I went to the Australian Short Story Festival a few years ago in Perth, and David Malouf gave the opening address, and he said it in a way that makes it sound easy, which it isn't. But he said endings are kind of simple. You just have to tumble towards them. You have to tumble towards your endings, which I guess is sort of speaking to the idea of they need to sound a bit effortless, but also sometimes you can do that bit of reverse engineering. And he was saying, what's at the beginning of the story? What is at the beginning that is already that I have? It's like I've given myself my own clues. Like, what have I given myself? That is, I'm telling myself how to end it. It's like a little mystery for yourself.
Yeah, that's so interesting. It reminds me of crime, the way that you put it, as in it's so inevitable and surprising simultaneously.
Yeah. And it's also fine, I think, to totally reverse engineer a short story. Like, it doesn't have to just be this one beautiful, thing that emerges perfectly in 3,000 words or 5,000 words. Like, if you get to the end, if I get to the end and I think this absolutely has to end in this way, I need to go back and tear it down the beginning, or I need to, you know, lay the groundwork much earlier on for this to feel, like you said, surprising or inevitable or both.
And do you do that? Do you find yourself doing that at the selection of word level, like creating a, like you mentioned talking about, that one collection may have been grimmer and trying to lighten it the next time around. Do you, if you're flip-flopping with an ending and you say, no, I'm going to make it a happier ending, or I'm making things sound very simplistic, but then do you, to lay that down, are the words, you choose happier words throughout to take you there, or?
No, I think more at a plot level.
Okay.
And I'll give you another example. When I handed in the manuscript for Ordinary Matter in August last year, and I love being edited. Like, I love it.
It's such a gift. My God, that anyone would care so much.
It's just so joyful. Like, tell me what I've done wrong. Tell me what I've done right. But tell me what I've done wrong. And so that structural edit is really interesting to me, especially in a short story collection, like a structural edit. Like I said, Trick of the Light was a much lighter edit, I feel, whereas this one was sort of, Laura, did you know that here are the things that you often, here is the ground that you cover, that you probably don't even know you've covered this same ground, or here are the, you know, those sorts of things with a short story collection. So these things keep recurring. Do you want them to keep recurring? That kind of stuff.
So what sort of things were they? What would be an example of that?
That had an ending. What was the story? It was Witnessing, which is a story I wrote. I wrote the first 1,000 words of that in this furious kind of fugue state after my son was born, where I felt like I would never write anything ever again. And then he was down for a nap, and I wrote 1,000 words of that story, like the first 1,000 words. And it was just like,
oh my God, you're an actual person.
I have news for you. This is the greatest day of our lives. That felt really good. So that's why I remember our Witnessing. Anyway, the ending of Witnessing was really different. And so it ends with this girl and her auntie on a service station. They're about to sort of start their new lives together after this girl's mother has died, and she's with her auntie, and the end of the story had the auntie making a phone call back home to this boyfriend who's been mentioned throughout the story that we've never met, and she said something kind of different about their lives on this phone call. And in that structural edit, my publisher and editor pointed out that it was about babies and motherhood again. And I am a bit obsessed with it. And it does recur throughout the collection. But actually giving her something else to say and returning that conversation, the conversation, instead of calling this boyfriend who we haven't had anything really to do with, we're left with the girl and her auntie who we've been with through the whole story, and they have their own little scene together. And it's a much better ending, I think, than what I'd originally given them.
Yeah, interesting.
So that was quite a big change in that it was like cut a whole part, write a whole new part, which again, love being edited. And usually your first reaction might be, oh God, do I want to do that? How will I do that?
But it can feel very exposing too, to be like, you're obsessed with this one thing. Well, like, what is your...
Yes, well, what's your deal? But then the other thing, the other counterpoint to that, Catherine, I reckon, is I used to say this to my university students when I was a tutor. Fiona Wright said it, and I quote it all the time, where she said, trust your obsessions.
Mm.
And I do think that is also really useful advice that
That's great advice.
Whenever I'm beating myself up about it, I'd be like, no, Laura, trust them, go with them. Like, these are the things you're interested in. Find a new way to tell that story, but it's okay that I'm not interested in so many things, but go with what you are interested in and just freshen it up a bit.
That is great advice. We should mention that the second short story collection that we're talking about is called Ordinary Matter, and it centres on the lives of 20 women that won Nobel Peace Prizes for science. That's the starting off point for these stories. So they're sort of grounded around real people. How important is a reality when you're writing these stories, or is it really just a jumping off point?
That's a good question. So, 20 women have won in either chemistry, physics or medicine and physiology 20 times, so 19 women. It's something like 650 men since 1901, and only one Australian woman. So my jumping off point for the whole collection was kind of her. So she's Elizabeth Blackburn, and she was born in Tasmania. She's still alive, lives in America, and I had never heard of her. So I thought that was interesting. And when I spoke to people, even, people who I might have expected, like my scientist friends, they'd vaguely heard of her. So she was the first one I wrote. Her story is the longest and the first that I wrote. And I took, in terms of like, was it jumping off? I took part of her reality, which was that she was born in Tasmania. But then I kind of made what I call a little parallel Elizabeth, a little para Elizabeth. And she is a different sort of girl, around the same age that Elizabeth would have been, slightly different family. And I've taken a detail out of a biography I read of her. So a woman named Catherine Brady wrote a biography about her, and I took a little detail from that book. And for some of the women, it really was taking like a line about their real lives. And so in some of the stories, the women are there, you know, front and centre, like Marie Curie appeared in her second story. She's there with her two daughters. They actually did go to America, and the president of the USA handed her the keys to a lockbox that had a gram of radium, and thousands of people greeted Marie Curie at New York Harbour, like Beyonce style. It was incredible. So she's in that story, but then in other stories,
that's the one that's from the point of view of the creepy, like.
Yes. Yeah, so I made up a creepy man. Thank
you. So creepy.
Thank you. But, you know, like, he has texture too. Well.
Yeah, he totally does.
So I wanted to take a real moment in history for that story, Grand Canyon, and then create a periphery character who might have existed, who was in their circle, staying at the Waldorf Astoria with them, trekking from New York all the way across America to the Grand Canyon. Like, who might have been in their entourage? Because they were there for weeks. Marie Curie's health was failing, but she took her two daughters, very reluctantly went to America to get this radium. For other women, I was more interested in, you know, like Tu Yu Yu, who is from, when did she win? She won, she's the third last story for malaria, for coming up with a cure for treatment for malaria. I was much more interested there in the ramifications of her work on people's health. And Gertrude Elion, her research has saved literally millions of people's lives. So the research sort of bounced around from who were these women and what were their lives like to what did they do, how does their work kind of manifest now, or how might it have, you know, infiltrated a character's life.
So a lot of, as you said, 20 different stories or 19 women, only one of whom has come from Australia, and they span also a pretty massive stretch of time. But in terms of place, how did you go about building places or anchoring? Because they're very grounded in the place that they're set.
So at the very outset when I was planning it, I didn't know what it would look like, Catherine. I really didn't. I knew I had this idea and I was writing a grant application and I was like, got to make something up. So I made something up. And I was a bit I felt restricted at the start because I wasn't sure where they should be set. When
they're on boats, they're in corn parades.
Thank you for noticing. yes, they're in Sunshine Coast, Queensland. So I wanted to. Originally, I was like, oh my God, each of these stories, I have to set them in 1903 and then 1911 and 1947. And I felt really, that felt really hard. And so I said to my writers group, hello, please give me permission to do whatever I want. And they were like, here's your permission. And so as soon as I did that, I was like, well, why can't Irene Joliot-Curie's story be set in Sunshine Coast, Queensland? Yeah. In a give or take contemporary Australian setting where there are hints of climate change and there's a woman who has a job and has a husband and she's totally out of, you know, like she, this character is not in France in the 30s. So I think the settings came out with the plot. The ship, yeah, Gertie Corey, who migrated to America, I was like, ship, that's interesting. That idea of this migrant who's leaving America for a range of reasons. Her husband's already been in America for 6 months. Why not set a story, a brief story, during her time on this ship? She's leaving something behind. She doesn't know what is ahead of her. So as soon as I gave myself the freedom to set them wherever I wanted, to not have the woman feature in every single one, that was really fun. That was, you can do whatever you want.
Yeah, you can. It's so weird how we, like, just that writer's group permission thing. I totally get it. Like, why? Yeah. But I get it at the same time.
Yeah.
So, Laura, where and when do you write?
Where and when do I write?
I'm looking at you. I have to give a visual for listeners because you are currently in a cupboard.
Yes.
So it's a walk-in robe, which I would actually kill for. Yes. But it does sort of paint a picture of cramming things in between other aspects of life.
I'm in my parent. I've assured my dad that no one else will see this except for Catherine. So I'm in my parents' walk-in wardrobe, shirts, baskets, luggages, suitcases, while my parents babysit outside. They've gone for a walk. So that does give you a bit of an indication. It's really soundproof in a wardrobe, did you know? Yeah, so when do I write? I don't know. I have, look, half of this book, the good answer is that half of this book was written at Varuna.
Oh, my God.
10 stories were written at Varuna. I've added it.
Over so, a week or a fortnight?
God, no. So I've had 3 trips to Varuna, all for this book. But the last time, the most recent time I was at Varuna was July last year, and the book was due in about 2 weeks. And I had written 15 of the stories and I had 5 to go.
Oh, wow.
So I love a deadline. Like I said, I love a bit of like, please give me some pressure. And I was about, I think it was due, and I was about to start a new job, which is my 4-day-a-week job. And I was about to start that the day after I got back from Varuna. So I knew there'd be no time other than Varuna time. And so I went there and I've always had lovely groups. Have you been to Varuna?
I have. I've been twice. I've done 2 1-week stints and they were both lovely. One was a little bit dysfunctional, I have to say, but that was kind of cool in itself.
Fun too. No, I've had deeply functional ones. So this July time, I turned up, and you know, at the start, everyone says what they need to get done. I said, I have 5 stories to write this week, and I'm not kidding with you. I'm not mucking around, people. And in that really lovely way where you don't see them all day, and then you'd come down, I'd come down at night, and they'd be like, did you do it? And I'd say, I mean, these are like first draft. I'm talking first draft story. But I had to end up, doing it, five times.
So did you do a new story each day for something like that? Or you do,
new one each day. Most of the stories take a lot longer than that, but these were first drafts that I just had to get off as part of this whole manuscript to my editor the next week. And, but there is like, there's something really fun about that. Like you've got 6 hours and I've got these great, people in my writers group and sort of a bit beyond that, where I could say at 3 PM, hello, I've written this all day today. Is it garbage? Does it have legs? If it's only 6 hours, like I don't feel precious about, handing off work to people. I feel really, I think that's a good skill to have, is to be like, you can be honest with me at this 6 hour mark. Like if it's terrible, just tell me. If it's not, I'll keep going.
And it's a quick feedback loop then too, isn't it? Like, you know, it takes them half an hour to read. They can be back to you within an hour.
And we do that. I do that for other people as well. And I think it's extremely useful.
Nice.
And the other time I write, I guess, is, I mean, when do you write at night? On the weekends?
I'm more morning, but...
Morning.
I didn't think I could do night. I'm not that good for much.
Once the kids are in bed, I can do a little bit, or I can edit a story or something at night. But it is hard to find... It's getting harder to find time, actually. Yeah.
All right, let's talk about advice for other writers. I think a lot of people start out or attempt short stories thinking, oh, this is an easier version of a larger thing, perhaps, and it's a discovery that it's very much its own quite particular art form. What advice would you have for people attempting short stories?
Read a lot of short story collections. Sounds obvious, doesn't it? That's what I do. Is I just I actually really enjoy single author short story collections.
What is it about single author that appeals so much?
There was a, who was it who said this that I really like? Maybe it's this reason. She, Laura Vandenberg, who's an American short story writer, and she's a novelist as well. And she said, a short story collection by a single author, she said it's like something like this. She said it's like roaming someone's house, someone's property. Mm. You're roaming a property, and every story should feel like I'm picking up a stone and seeing what's underneath, or I'm walking up the steps here, or I'm looking behind the tree here. And so it's still this one single entity, still one person's brain, but you're getting a little feel for that person.
I love that.
Roaming it. I love that too. So
did you read many of the, this is off topic, but the Sleeper's Almanacs?
Yes, I love the Sleeper's Almanac. I've got
They were so good. I mean, that's the complete opposite, but I loved that for discovering a person.
Yes, and like the new Australian fiction, that Kill Your Darlings one. Mm. Yeah, I mean, I read multi-author as well as single author. And I also listen to short story podcasts as well. I really like hearing authors read their stories. And I guess the other advice is things I used to do would be set myself rules, like write a story that covers 50 years.
Yeah, right.
Or write a story that can only take place in these 2 hours, or write a story that has a tone like XYZ and see if you can, you know, like.
Yeah.
Images. Yeah.
Let's talk about social media. You are so good on Twitter. I wondered if you thought about Twitter as a tiny story, or do you have a way that you approach it?
Oh, really? I really enjoy Twitter as a writer, and being all the things that other of your guests have said, Catherine, about you get to actually like communicate with famous humans who will.
It's extraordinary, isn't it? For that, absolutely.
At someone who's very cool, and I find it useful as well for call outs and competitions and those sorts of things, and connecting with people and talking about people's books and book recommendations and things like that. And the one I don't do is Facebook. Not interested in doing Facebook. I have a website, but I just like that you can have these conversations and see what other people are doing and support other, you know, it sounds a bit.
Do you filter yourself when you, because you do, and some people don't do it as much, but you will, you do like, I'm doing this or this is happening to me. Do you filter yourself when you pick in what you say in your sort of more offhand remarks about life?
I probably,
or do you just not even think about it?
Oh, no, I do. I probably, I swear a lot more in real life than I try to on social, media. I'm fine with talking about like things that are going on in my house, things my children have said that I find that are funny. But also that's how I read my news. Like I find out about that's, someone asked me that the other day, maybe like my uncle was like, what do you find? Mm. How do you, so that's what I do is I use it as, I really do find quite serious things, and I'm informed by Twitter as a writer as well as each.
Do you ever have to take breaks from it, or it's
yeah, yes, I do sometimes, and I can be like when I'm at Varuna, I'll do that freedom blocker.
Yeah,
I'll do that, and I do that sometimes during the day, just give myself little sessions. And I mean, at the moment, I'm working from home, so I'm doing my, you know, as many people are, I'm doing my job from home. And so all the other distractions of working from home and writing and, I don't know, global destruction and pandemic, all of those, just those things, sometimes, yes, taking a little
social
media, Twitter break is very helpful and smart probably, yeah.
Laura, what's your favourite piece of writing by a debut author?
Ooh, I'm going to say two, if that's okay.
Two.
Abigail Ullman wrote Hot Little Hands, which is the short story collection from 2015 that I adore.
I have read that, and one of those stories is permanently stuck in my head.
That's what I'm thinking of. Catherine, we're thinking of the same one story. A couple of stories in that book are just like the best, among the best Australian stories I've ever read.
She's fabulous.
She's fabulous. And the other one is a bit of a cheat because it isn't out yet, but it's Car Crash, a memoir by Lek Blaine, which is out next year. And it was supposed to be published around this time, but due to reasons, it is not. And I've read an early copy of Car Crash, and it is astonishingly good and very, very moving. So that's fantastic. Coming next year.
You can find the show notes for this episode on our website, thefirsttimepodcast.com. If you're feeling so inclined, we would love for you to leave us a review wherever you listen. This helps other people find us.
Get in touch with us via the contact page on our website or connect with the entire First Time gang on Twitter or Instagram at The First Time Pod. And don't forget, you can support us via Patreon. Go to patreon.com/thefirsttimepodcast. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to The First Time Podcast. We recorded this episode at Kathleen Syme Library on the traditional lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. The First Time Podcast is produced by Phoebe 80 and supported by Writers Victoria, the ACT Writers Centre, and our wonderful patrons.